community would see an increase in deployment orders, including involuntary call-ups. One drill weekend, I encountered an unusually grumpy Lieutenant Murray, who explained that he had been abruptly and involuntarily called up for duty in East Africa. In his case, that meant suspending a successful law practice, leaving a spouse and kids, and packing his bags for Djibouti. He was very much a key employee at his solo office, but that, too, did not rate a yes answer on the screening questionnaire. The needs of the Navy came first. Before even taking office as mayor, I had made sure our team had a clear plan on what to do if I got mobilized. Some decisions would have to depend on the circumstances, of course, but we gathered all the information needed on legal and regulatory procedures and made several contingency plans. Now, with deployment orders coming in more and more frequently, especially for officers holding the rank of lieutenant, which was what I would become in late 2013, I told the team at home to be ready and made sure my chain of command knew that I would rather go sooner than later and would rather go to Afghanistan than anywhere else. Because I was a specialist in counterterrorism, Afghanistan represented the best place in the world to practice my craft. It was also a country, troubled but also hauntingly beautiful, that I had gotten to know while a civilian advisor at McKinsey. If my turn was coming up to get mobilized, I wanted it to be there. "An adventure is only an inconvenience rightly considered," said my friend and colleague Scott Ford, quoting G.K. Chesterton as he raised a glass of scotch. A few of us friends had gathered for one last dinner and round of drinks before I headed to Chicago with my parents, orders in hand, and then off to the sequence of bases and waypoints that would lead me eventually to Kabul. We got into the good whiskey and shared jokes until late at night. It was a good way to think of the coming deployment, an adventure, among many other things. But I also noted, with guilt, that this would be more than an inconvenience for my administration. We were full steam ahead on a number of ambitious initiatives, as I've described, addressing 1,000 vacant houses, staging for the 150th anniversary celebration of the city, and redesigning the two major arteries in our downtown streetscape, to name a few. My office staff and department heads would now have to continue making progress on all of these efforts without me there to supply political cover, day-to-day guidance, or media engagement. But by the time I got my official orders in the fall of 2013, calling me up to report the next February for duty with the Afghanistan Threat Finance Cell, we were prepared. Catherine Roos, my hyper-competent chief of staff, had worked so closely with me that she could intuitively gauge how I would answer most questions before they even came to me. And Mark Neal, the city controller, whom I had asked to assume the role of deputy mayor in my absence, would be an excellent community voice in my stead. Mark was an accomplished business leader, a former CFO of a major health company in town, whose work for the city was uncomplicated by political aspirations. Our original arrangement had called for him to serve the city for 2 years as controller, before going back to private life. But right about the time he was getting ready to leave the administration, I had to approach him with an almost comically disruptive request: to temporarily take over and lead the city during my deployment. He declined, which I took as further proof that he was the right person for the job. There was no personal ambition here, no political agenda. He just wanted what was best for the city. I persisted, and eventually he agreed. Over breakfast at my house shortly before leaving, I went over final plans with Mark. Here's what to do if there's a weather emergency. Here's the best way to get a hold of me abroad. Here are the main priorities to stick with and the ones we can sacrifice if we have to. Then, gently smiling, as he did whenever we were about to tackle a delicate issue, Mark raised the one question no one else had wanted to ask. "What if you don't come back, Pete?" I glanced down at the table, trying to field the question the same as if I'd been asked what to do if the council denied a mid-year budget appropriation. "There's a letter in the desk drawer upstairs," I said. That was for the personal stuff. As for the city, it would be a vacancy. They'll have to find someone new, and it'll get political. I guess if it gets to that point, I won't be any help. Soon, I was at Naval Station Great Lakes, completing the first stages of mobilization and commencing the strange shift in identity and status that awaited me. The base commanding officer was away, so the Command Master Chief did the honors of signing off on my deployment packet after I had completed the scavenger hunt of requisite medical, fitness, training, and administrative checks. He looked over the paperwork one last time in his office and asked if I felt I had everything in order on the personal side. "Got any kids?" "No." "Wife?" "Nope." "Girlfriend?" "No, I'm single." "Well, that'll make it easier." "Is your employer supportive?" Very, I answered, thinking of Catherine, Mark, and the rest of my staff. Everyone has been great. That's good, he said. If you still feel that way when you get back, you can put them in for an ESGR, meaning Employer Supportive Guard and Reserve, award. I'll remember that, I muttered. But that would be like giving myself an award, I thought, so it probably wouldn't work in this case. You said you worked for the city, right? That's right. Well, you should definitely put them in for the award then, especially if you need to brown nose a little. When they do those award presentations, the elected officials always come. They love standing next to military, and they just eat that shit up. A few weeks later, I sat, poker-faced, in a training room as a furious commander berated the troops at Camp McCready outside Fort Jackson, South Carolina. We had been there for a few days, all Navy personnel assigned to Army-style jobs in combat zones, being trained to serve as the land-based dirt sailors we were about to become. It came after Great Lakes, after Norfolk, the last stage before going overseas. We learned Army lingo, convoy operations, and, of course, shooting. But some officers had been underperforming, and the executive officer was not pleased. One by one, he called up officers who had done something that displeased him, had them turn and face the others, and yelled out each of their deficiencies. One had been observed getting food ahead of the enlisted sailors in line, and disparaging the drill instructors behind their backs. He was dismissed on the spot. A lieutenant was called up for filling her Camelback liquid dispenser with soda, also forbidden. He took it off her back and flung it across the room. It felt like I was back in middle school, and like any bystander to the disciplining of one's peers, I kept my eyes down and waited for it all to end, not realizing my turn was next. After dispatching his last victim, the commander glanced down at a crumpled piece of paper in his hand, then looked back up at the group. Now, who in the hell is Lieutenant Budinger? No one budged. Slowly and with dread it dawned on me, I was Lieutenant Budinger. As soon as I came to terms with this inevitable reality, I was on my feet. I stood front and center, staring dead ahead of me, getting yelled at, confused. You want to argue with the drill sergeant, Lieutenant? No, sir. You realize what these guys have been through and what they do to make sure you're ready for a combat zone? I sure did. I admired the drill instructors from the South Carolina Army National Guard, who spent their days showing us sailors how to function as soldiers. I also had no idea what he was mad about. But I knew enough not to reveal any perplexity, let alone try to plead my case. Yes, sir. No excuse, sir. Get back to your seat, he said, seeming to have unwound just a little. Yes, sir. A few days later, I was back under the gaze of Commander Clark, whose countenance and demeanor gave him more than a passing resemblance to Steve Carell from The Office. Well, Lieutenant Butterig, it looks like I owe you an apology. It turned out I had been confused with another trainee, and he had called me into his office to clear it up. I appreciated that gesture, though it would have been nice if he had done this in front of the others. Our class division officer later took care of that at morning formation. The mistaken identity case was the final seal on the status shift I had experienced, going from a mayor in charge of a small bureaucracy to a minor figure in the biggest bureaucracy in the world. At home, I was accustomed to people being angry at me, perhaps over a policy decision, police controversy, or pothole problem. But at least that was for things that actually happened, based on who I actually was. The one indignity I never experienced at home as mayor was someone mistaking me for someone else. But here, even as an officer, I was no one in particular. At the mayor's office, my name is printed on the door, but here at Camp McCready, my surname wasn't even spelled right on my camouflage uniform when it was first issued to me. The rank was all that mattered. The name was a minor detail. Indeed, the most vital piece of information on me was neither name nor rank, but the letters O space POS, punched into the metal below my social security number and above the abbreviation EPISC, on my dog tag. Do not guess your blood type, shipmates, the NCO had joked as we filled in the forms to go to the dog tag maker. We all chuckled, but when they came to pass them out, it felt like we held in our hands an emblem of our mortality as well as our military identity. I was told to separate the two tags I'd been issued. Do your family a favor, someone had said, showing me how to lace one tag into one of my combat boots while the other stayed around my neck. That way, they could figure out who you had been, even if your leg wound up in a different place than the rest of you. Who here thinks you won't be going on a convoy? Asked the Admiral, introducing the final round of training. He was a cheerful two-star, tall and lean, seeming to enjoy having an occasion to wear the camouflage uniform instead of the dress blues of the Pentagon. His talk had been engaging, and now he let the dramatic pause linger after his question. Like all admirals, generals, mayors, and bishops, he was a politician. Most of us figured out that the question was rhetorical, though it was also puzzling. Our group consisted of personnel specialists, medics, and intelligence analysts. In theory, very few of us would wind up in a convoy. Still, it seemed like yes was not the correct answer here. Only half a dozen naive hands went up. Guess what? All of you are probably going on a convoy. We all understood that our deployments were not traditional naval assignments. We would be nowhere near a ship, and should be prepared for unconventional duties. We were the so-called individual augmentees, mobilizing one at a time to join other units, rather than with a company or a ship's crew. Still, the idea that we needed to learn convoy security seemed peculiar. We had joined the Navy, not the Army. But by now it was clear to us that we needed to be ready for anything. Months later, as I counted my 100th time outside the wire behind the wheel, I thought of that moment. We may have started our Navy Reserve careers learning about ships and cruise missiles, but right now we needed to learn about Humvees, medevacs, and IEDs. The culminating event of the 3-week combat training sequence was an all-day convoy simulation, where we proceeded through a threat-filled third-world village, a slice of Afghanistan, or Somalia or Iraq if you preferred, in the South Carolina woods. Advice was dispensed along the way, with occasional reminders that we were not supposed to be in combat roles, but would have to learn these things just in case. We learned the procedure for what to do when your vehicle is stopped, scanning the immediate area and outer radius for signs of an IED. But there was only time to learn the basics. None of us would be defusing bombs, but we needed to know how to act if we encountered one. Drill Sergeant, is there a standard procedure for what to do if you actually see one during the walk-around? Yes. Get your ass back in the vehicle. The response was typical of the drill instructors, brusque enough to make sure we understood the stakes, but also marked by the camaraderie and gruff humor of frontline soldiers. Some of them had been through 5 or more deployments, even though many were younger than I was. They wanted us to be prepared for all of the things they had seen downrange. Our magazines were full of blanks, but the rifles we carried were the ones we would take to war. There was downtime in between stages of the simulation, but every minute was supposed to be for some purpose, if only double-checking your weapon and your battle buddy to make sure they were in good shape. If you are standing around not doing nothing, you are wrong! Halfway through the scenario, some sailors forgot their guidance, got ambitious, and decided to clear a building. Wrong move. The correct course of action here was to retreat to the armored vehicle and assess the threat. Unimpressed, a drill instructor pointed to the tallest, heaviest sailor in the group. You're dead now. The rest of us, left to drag him back to the vehicle as shots rang out from all around us, remembered the lesson. After it all ended, we gathered for an after-action review. Sweating under our body armor, we shifted our weight from foot to foot, taking the occasional pull of water from our camelbacks and holding on to our rifles as the instructors reviewed what we'd done right and wrong, blow by blow. Good job spotting the first IED. Don't forget to talk to your gunner. You should have had all the lines of the medevac report ready before getting on the radio to call it in. It was clinical at first, but this last day, the tone of some of the instructors began to change from the deadpan style they had projected since our arrival. A drill sergeant got quiet and stared into the distance for a moment before naming a friend who was killed in Iraq, leaving a wife and 5 kids. They have to live with that every day now, he said. He went on, brotherly, reminding us that we were being trained to know what to do if action finds us, but we're not supposed to look for combat if we didn't have to. Remember, he said, if you get killed, the war's over for you. But the people you leave behind, they'll be fighting it for the rest of their lives. So before any of you decide to go off and be a hero, think about that shit for a minute. And we all did, uncharacteristically quiet, until the bus came to take us back to the barracks to pack. Chapter 15. The War's Over. As soon as my war began, I wondered when and how it would end. Hopefully in September, when my orders were supposed to conclude. And hopefully, by then, there would be further signs of success in the American mission. But I had only been on the ground for a few days when someone told me to leave the idea of winning and losing behind. Smoking Gurkha cigars around the fire pit with my new colleagues, I was still finding my social bearings as we swapped stories in the light of a Weber grill filled with scrap wood. This being an intel unit, they had of course looked up the new guy before I arrived, but by now most of the interest and amusement over my own backstory had already run its course. We were back to talking, as usual, about the war and where it was headed. I had volunteered some ideas about what it would take to win in the border regions when Rob, an analyst, leaned back in his chair and laconically interrupted me. "The war's over, Pete." For a quiet moment, the words hung in the air with the cigar smoke and the dust of Bagram Airfield. My blood pressure rose as responses flowed through my mind. "What do you mean the war is over? If the war's over, why are you here? Why am I here? If the war's over, what the hell was that rocket attack last night? If the war's over, then somebody should tell whoever keeps shooting rockets at us. They might like to know." But I held my peace, trying to mimic the affect of the others, that tired ease and casually annoyed humor of resting soldiers, as we sat and smoked and glared at the fire. I got up to fetch more firewood from our pile of chopped-up old pallets. I wasn't prepared to argue with the most respected analyst in our unit, bearded and world-weary, so that it was easy to forget that he was my age, possibly even younger, and who had been working on terrorism analysis for years. Besides, he wasn't wrong. His point was that America wouldn't confront Pakistan over support to fighters wreaking havoc on the Afghan side of the Durand Line. The U.S. wasn't going to endanger its strategic 60-year relationship with Pakistan over some little thing like the Afghanistan War. It was 2014, and we might still be getting rockets shot at us from time to time, but there was only so much America could or would do about it. If winning the war meant sinking our relationship with Pakistan, then yes, the war might as well be over. And yet, here we were, on a cold night in dusty Parwan province, because wars like this one don't just end. I would spend the rest of my deployment wondering exactly what it means for one of today's wars to be truly over, and how anyone would be able to tell. By April, as the snow was melting on the mountains over Bagram, I had been moved to Kabul and was starting to feel like I had my feet on the ground as an officer. As the admiral had foreshadowed, I got out more than you would expect for an intelligence analyst. I might have planned to spend my time behind a sophisticated computer terminal in a secure area somewhere, and sometimes that's just what I did, but it turned out my services were more often needed as a driver or vehicle commander on convoys moving people or gear in and around Kabul for my unit. In a ritual to be repeated dozens of times, I would heave my armored torso into the driver's seat of a Land Cruiser, chamber around in my M4, lock the doors, and wave a gloved goodbye to the Macedonian gate guard. My vehicle would cross outside the wire and into the boisterous Afghan city, entering a world infinitely more interesting and ordinary and dangerous than our zone behind the blast walls at ISAF headquarters. On the streets that spring and summer, I obtained the strange mental balance required of anyone operating outside the wire in a conflict zone. In order to figure out how to conduct yourself, you must hold two contradictory truths in your mind. Truth number one, the vast majority of people you see through the windshield are just regular people, just like at home, trying to get through their day, out to shop and work and study and do all the things people do. You have a moral as well as strategic obligation to respect them, to drive carefully so you don't hit a kid on his way to school or a widow begging in the street or someone's uncle carrying home a watermelon, to act in such a way as to help or at least not harm them in their daily routines. Truth number two, with your rifle, your gear, your vehicle, and your passengers, you are quite obviously an American soldier, or sailor in my case, and accordingly, you must recognize that a small but non-trivial number of the people you see around you are spending their every waking minute figuring out how to kill you and your passengers, and will do so if given the slightest opportunity, unless you avoid them or kill them first. My first couple times out, I had prepared by practically memorizing the regular driver's briefings, page after page of information on the latest threat streams, the suspicious vehicles, the rumors and reporting. But soon I gave up on trying to understand the details of the threats. The warnings on known VBIDs, vehicle-borne improvised explosive devices, usually boil down to this useless advice: watch out for the white Corolla. In Kabul, pretty much everyone drives a white Corolla. So I fell back on my training from Camp McCready, eyes out for the known signs that we were about to get blown up. A suddenly empty neighborhood, a nervous-looking lone driver of a vehicle with a heavy trunk load, an obviously male hand coming out from underneath a woman's blue burqa. Quickly, I learned how to drive at war. But what I saw through the windshield didn't look like a war. It looked like a city. A lively, energetic, smelly city full of children and merchants hawking things, and students and businessmen with papers under their arms hustling to wherever it was they were going. Children were everywhere, and I wondered how it came to be that this boy was herding a flock of sheep grazing on piled garbage near a busy intersection, while that one was in a crisp blue Oxford shirt in his own flock of identical blue-shirted classmates charging across a four-lane road toward school. I wondered what was on the minds of the girls in black dresses and white headscarves, holding their notebooks to their chests like so many 12-year-old girls do, never seen on the streets except in these little groups in their school uniforms. Inevitably, I also thought of municipal services and scanned Kabul with a mayor's eye view. I gauged what seemed to be done well, curb painting and lighting, poorly, trash pickup, and not at all, like animal control. I thought of home, where people would be crisscrossing South Bend with no thought at all given to how they might obtain clean water, whether trash would ever get picked up off the side of the road, whether there were any bombs nearby. Contrary to what I'd been told, the traffic had its rhythm, a sort of order dressed in chaos, as in Italy. Roundabouts had their flow and sometimes a counterflow. Donkeys competed with tanker trucks. Everyone beeped, and if you paid attention, it all followed a certain logic. In the middle of it all, always there were street sweepers, anachronistic in neon orange safety jackets with straw brooms, clearing the ubiquitous dust off the road between Masoud Circle and the airport, sweeping it nowhere in particular, never looking up at me or anyone else swerving to avoid them, heads down, fearless or oblivious. Did they think the war was over? Of course, there were checkpoints, sandbags, soldiers, a bomb site where broken glass dangled in storefronts for weeks. And the war was busy claiming lives. One day, an American duty driver got caught up at a checkpoint on the airport road, as I sometimes did, and got out to argue with the Afghan soldiers, as I occasionally would, and a Talib, passing by on a motorcycle or bicycle, noticed him, stopped and got off his bike, cut his throat, got back on his bike, and left while the American soldier bled out. That night, the local TV news reported the killing, showing the street sweepers, with their heads down as always, sweeping bloody sand out of the roadway toward the median. The longer I was there, unable to answer the question of how you can tell when a war is over, the more a second question rose in my mind alongside it. If you manage to get killed in a war that's over, what does that make you? That May, President Obama finally made his drawdown announcement, after weeks of rumors. The American troop strength would fall to 9,800 by the end of 2014, to be cut in half the year after that, and then out. The gunny sergeant walked into the office, a modified shipping container he called our tuna can. He took a seat and put his feet up, inspecting his pistol while I glanced at emails and fiddled absentmindedly with my knife. "I feel sorry for the people coming in 2015," he said. "If you're here now and something happens to you, then fine, we're late in the game, but everyone understands we're here for a reason. But being here after we said we're leaving? Getting shot at when everyone at home doesn't even think the war's going on still? Then why the fuck are you even out here, dog?" I tried to figure out if the president's announcement meant that the real war was to end in 2014, when Operation Enduring Freedom turned into Resolute Support, just as Iraqi freedom turned into New Dawn in 2010. Or in 2016, when the troops would, we thought, all be gone. Or some other date. Most Americans get our first understanding of wars from history books, starting with the dates each war began and ended. As with a human life, the span of a war is there in parentheses right after its name. The implication is that wars, like people, go from non-existence to being, and then back to non-existence, all at a precise time and date. We grow up assuming wars have beginnings and endings, but that date is only the object of consensus after the fact, if at all. In the days after I had announced my deployment orders publicly, I occasionally got a puzzled response from people who seemed confused or even irritated by the idea that I would be going over. "I thought we were getting out of there," they'd say, as if I should be calling the Navy back to check if there was some kind of mistake. At the outset of the mobilization, I had felt a sense of purpose, maybe even idealism, that can only be compared to the feeling of starting on a political campaign. I thought back to 2004 and John Kerry's presidential run, and then remembered that it was during that campaign that I saw the iconic footage of his testimony as the spokesman for Vietnam Veterans Against the War, long-haired and still in his 20s. "How do you ask a man," he had asked the senators then, "to be the last man to die for a mistake?" I did not believe the Afghanistan war was a mistake, but as I weighed my place in a war most people at home seemed to think was already ending, I couldn't stop wondering, how do you ask a person to be the last to die for anything? The rhythm of deployed life brought busy days and slow ones. Even with the extra time I spent keeping up with the home front, carrying a laptop and a cigar up to the roof at midnight to pick up a Wi-Fi signal and patch via Skype into a staff meeting at home, there was more time for reflection and reading than I was used to back home. For every day punctuated by a rocket attack or explosion, there were five dominated by meetings, emails, and workouts. Between calls home, convoys, and meals, I sat at the computer in my tuna can and looked up the history of wars beginning and ending. I read about how World War I ended at 11 in the morning on November 11, 1918. The armistice was signed at 5 in the morning, but set to take effect at 11. In those 6 hours, there were thousands of casualties. An American soldier was killed at 10:59 after he decided to use the last 60 seconds of the war to charge a German position. If the armistice had been agreed on the 10th of November or the 12th, would anyone have bothered to set a time instead of letting it take immediate effect? Did the negotiators place any weight on the loss of life required for their tidy numerology? By August, as my unit's only remaining officer at the thinning ISAF headquarters in Kabul, I was told in no uncertain terms that my mission now had less to do with running our little station there than with shutting it down. The gunny sergeant, my right-hand man, went home to rejoin his wife and four boys in South Carolina, leaving me with one analyst. In the fluorescent-lit chow hall, with officers from another unit, I would end meals by rising from the table with mock self-importance, saying, "Well, time to go check on my troops." This was the cue for one of the others to ritually supply the punchline to that joke. "You mean your troop." But the mission, which had to do with blocking the flow of narcotics funding to the insurgency, still mattered. So even as I worked to dismantle our shop, I got busy looking for people to take up pieces of ongoing work that we could hand off. A British law enforcement partner who might still be there in a year working out of the UK embassy. A State Department civilian whose head didn't count against the 9800. Some special units with a mission to stay throughout the retrograde. Or one of the Afghan officials I had met who were going to wind up owning these problems anyway. Letting go of the mission did not come easily, but clinging to it raised other concerns. What if I was doing something wrong by pushing too hard, risking my life and others to keep going outside the confines of the base in order to see the mission through, while being told from on high to wrap it up? I owed it to anyone who got into a vehicle with me, and their spouses, to make sure we weren't taking any unjustified risks. In my eagerness to finish strong, how could I be sure I wasn't entering the grim tradition of officers, like the ones who had ordered those deadly advances that November morning in 1918, in order to get a few more inches of turf by 11, who didn't recognize when their job was done, their war over. One slow day after chow, I googled Japanese World War II holdouts. On a Philippine island in 1945, as the war became desperate for the Japanese, Second Lieutenant Hirohō Onoda was ordered to take his three men into the jungle and come out for no one but his commanding officer. He and his men carried out raids and lived in the jungle for decades, all but Onoda eventually dying. He continued doing this for almost 30 years. Then, in 1974, as the Vietnam War was nearing its end, 800 miles due west across the South China Sea, a Japanese backpacker found him, out there, fighting World War II alone. True to his orders, Onoda refused to stand down unless relieved by the officer who had ordered him into the jungle. So the Japanese government actually tracked down the commander, Major Yoshimi Taniguchi, who was now an aging bookseller in Kyushu, and flew him to Lubang Island with an official set of orders relieving Onoda. Though he had effectively murdered a number of Filipinos living on the island, he was pardoned under the reasoning that he thought he was at war. He went home, quickly despaired at the sight of modern Japan, moved to Brazil, and became a cattle farmer. He died in January 2014, as I was packing my bags for Afghanistan. Onoda's war had lasted 34 years. Mine was less than 7 months, but it was long enough to encompass the excitement and uncertainty of 2 rounds of Afghan elections and a much-anticipated change of command at ISAF. I was also there during the second unending of the Second Iraq War. Sitting in the offices of another unit that mine worked with closely, I watched on the big screen, tuned to cable news, as the Iraq War went through its third beginning, and thought of the night in college in 2003 when I witnessed its first false ending, with President Bush on the deck of the USS Abraham Lincoln with a mission accomplished sign in the background. A decade later, I sat unsure what to say as the soldiers next to me, most of whom had served in Iraq too, bitterly realized that their efforts had come to this, the emergence of ISIS. It was as though, in a war without two simple sides, war itself was going to win in the end. The whole CENTCOM AOR is a dumpster fire, one side. My mind kept rotating around the question of whether there was any way at all to see the end of a war while it was being fought, or if you could only decide long afterward what had actually happened and when. Accompanying my commander on a visit to Camp Leatherneck, structured like a giant checkerboard in Helmand Province, I saw plot after big square plot of land emptied. Just a few areas were still up and running, the rest taken back down to gravel, like abandoned industrial sites in South Bend, only much tidier because they had been removed with the characteristic thoroughness of the Marines. There, Afghans in the on-base so-called Haji shops, who had been selling carpets and scarves and pirated DVDs to coalition forces for a decade, were bracing for the disappearance of their livelihoods. In the south, Kandahar had even more shops, arranged on a square boardwalk, designed to make you briefly forget that you were on an airbase in a war, noshing in your downtime on pizza or ice cream. But now the boardwalk storefronts were two-thirds empty, like at a dying mall back home. One instinct would tell you to feel a little wistful, as you would naturally feel when seeing anything built with great effort come to a slow end. Then another instinct would smack you awake, as you sensed the wrongness of feeling sentimental about the end of a war. But this guilt would recede as you noticed that the war itself was not the thing that was ending. I'd sit in a meeting about how to posture our unit for the coming retrograde of troops, thinking that the war was indeed pretty much over. Then I'd hear a briefing about the escalating count of Afghan National Security Forces killed that week, and wonder if our entire presence wasn't just a phase in a continuum of warfare that, to Afghans, did not begin when we invaded, and would not end when we left. And then, one day in September, the dust, noise, beauty, and danger of Afghanistan were all in my past. A C-17 lifted me and about 100 other Americans off Afghan soil for the last time. As our gray tail eased up from the Kandahar tarmac, there was no applause, no jubilation from the tired men and women aboard. I tried to work myself into some emotion about it, to savor the moment, or something, but it was just a flight. The next day I sat with Lieutenant Jason McCrae, my friend and battle buddy from training, in a surprisingly nice air-conditioned trailer made out to be a coffee shop amid the bleached bonescape that is Al Udeid Air Base in Qatar. Some 6 months earlier, I had walked at his side toward our barracks after the last hugs of the friends and family send-off at Camp McCready. We both kept our eyes forward, but I could feel the restraint on Jason's part as he avoided looking back at his bewildered 2-year-old, toddling after us, not comprehending why his father was walking away, crying and confused as his mother scooped him up to carry him in the opposite direction. Now, our war was over. It was time to go home. But time had no real meaning at this stopover base, washed in sunlight and jet lag. We all carried our personal time zone around us. You might be on your way to breakfast at the 24-hour chow hall and pass by a couple airmen on crew rest drinking beer in the morning sun before they go to bed. You might wake up uncontrollably at 3 in the morning and go to the running track to blow off energy and find a dozen others working out there. Everyone on our side of the base had some combination of Germany or Iraq or Bagram or America standing 24 to 48 hours in their past and future. But the Navy had its way of signaling that time still existed and that our war really was now finished. Starting today, Jason reminded me, we no longer drew imminent danger pay. Thumbing through his iPhone, Jason read a headline aloud. Suicide attack in Kabul. Over there, when I heard an explosion, the quickest way to learn what was going on was usually to search hashtag Kabul on Twitter, or quote Kabul attack, end quote, on Google. So I did the same now. I learned that it was near the ISAF compound where I'd lived and worked, possibly on the road to the airport. 2 Americans dead, no names yet. I quickly emailed the people I considered most likely to have been driving there at that time, and they promptly wrote back to confirm they were alive and bored. It wasn't until the next day that they released the identities of the casualties. and their pictures. Major Donahue had been with me on a trip to deliver clothing and school supplies to an orphanage. It was a volunteer mission, and everyone involved was motivated by a desire to do good, but also, at least in my case, aching for more real encounters with regular Afghans, even if it meant extra trips outside the wire. When we arrived, a contingent of Afghan Boy Scouts came to unload the supplies, and we spent the morning with them, a group of orphans, and the NGO workers at the site. The orphans were like any school kids, playful and lively and noisy. I gave them my camera to play with, and by the time I had it back, it was full of photos. The Afghan scouts, who were older, polite, and a little reticent, showed us the facility and explained their scouting program. Old enough to observe Ramadan, they quietly refused the candy we had brought before agreeing to pass it out to the little kids. Not having actually spoken to anyone under the age of 18 in months, for me it was a rare taste of normalcy, the best day of the deployment. Someone took a photo of me and Donahue standing in a classroom with a group of the kids, relaxed and smiling as one of the scouts uses the wrist of another to show us how to tie some elaborate knot they had learned. Nothing about the photo, other than our uniforms, of course, suggests that it was taken in the context of a war. Now, I looked at that same face, squared toward the camera in the serious and dignified look of a standard service portrait, alongside the text of a news story announcing his death. His war and mine had both ended, very differently, just one day apart. According to the customary recipe for a war story, baked with facts but leavened with bullshit, I ought to say that he and I were close, that he was the finest soldier I knew, a friend whose loss drew all of us who knew him closer together. In truth, I neither liked nor disliked Mike Donahue. He was a co-worker, a good soldier as far as I could tell. He spoke of being a father, and I believe he was good at that, too. I knew him well enough to be confident volunteering to ride in his vehicle, not well enough to confide in him or ask much about his life back home. So why was his death the casualty that affected me the most? I saw General Green more often, admired him for his down-to-earth style, and was as shocked as anyone when he was shot and killed during a graduation of Afghan troops at a training academy. I knew Senior Chief Hockenberry much better than either of them, and having talked with her earlier about things ranging from Navy life to her teenage son, I could vividly picture the lifelong impact of the serious gunshot injuries she sustained in that same incident. So why was the loss of this almost casual acquaintance the one my mind couldn't stop turning toward? Perhaps it was the timing, the knowledge that the war took him just as I left it behind. Amid the drawdown, I left a few days earlier than originally planned. Otherwise, I would have heard the explosion, so close to our quarters, assuming I was not out on a convoy myself. That must have been it. As different as he and I seemed, and as little as I really knew him, I could very much picture myself in his place. He drove vehicles around Kabul, just as I did. That day, he would have put on the same kind of body armor, waved goodbye to the same gate guard, signaled a turn onto the same road. So, he died the way I probably would have if I hadn't made it, the brutal luck of being chosen by an IED, never knowing who or what hit you. Visiting the forest of white markers in the Afghanistan section at Arlington is not just for honoring the individuals lost there. It is a place to seek some reason why they should be under the headstones while the rest of us walk around on the grass. I was sorry about his loss, but my real purpose visiting his gravesite and the others at Arlington is to confront the dictatorship of chance, which compounds the cruelty of loss by allocating it for no clear reason at all. To die taking a hill is one thing, but a soldier hit by an IED is basically the victim of an assassination. Like an assassin, the bomber is out to destroy a symbol, who happens to be a human being, without really knowing or caring about the most important qualities of his victim. Looking back, I see no good reason that can be confected for why one person and not another should die at random on a routine mission. For a mind that can't come to rest around that question, the only way out is to construct a reason going forward. You resolve to build a life that is somehow worthy of emerging on the better side of luck's absurd equations, because you know that, by definition, your luck is something you don't deserve. Nothing that had happened during the deployment would justify the pattern by which I returned safely and some of the others did not. But I had the rest of my life to try to repay whatever debt I had incurred by coming back in one piece. It all might sound superstitious, but the search for justification was an inescapable imperative for me, and another element of propulsion for my work at home. Not that it would really be possible to ever feel like I had settled this account, but it was clear that I would have to work harder than ever to make myself useful after these reminders of the precariousness of existence, not just in war zones, but in general. If this loss had happened while I was still deployed, it might have propelled me to try even harder, perhaps dangerously so, to make gains for my vanishing unit. But my war was over. If I wanted, somehow, to earn the luck that had brought me home safe from Afghanistan, I would have to do it from home, in South Bend. I may go months without thinking about the day I came home. Then some event will bring it all back, like the Vietnam Welcome Home event at a smoky dive bar called Catch 22. Nestled between houses on a residential block on 4th Street in Mishawaka, Catch 22 is a true neighborhood bar of the old school. Even though it's lunchtime, today I find it full to capacity, which means about 30 guests, taking every seat at the bar, the handful of high tops, and even the pool table, which has been covered for the occasion. Other than Mishawaka's mayor, Dave Wood, and a couple staff members, a reporter, and me, just about everyone is between 60 and 80 years old, wearing a ball cap or some other clothing, identifying him as a Vietnam veteran. After Mayor Wood says a few words of appreciation, I give my little speech, something like this. 4 years ago today, I landed in Afghanistan. And at the end of my tour, the reception couldn't have been better. At Baltimore-Washington Airport, people lined up to shake our hands, waving flags. When I got home to South Bend, people were waiting with balloons and gave me hugs. A little choked up, I continue to the point. Many of you did not get that welcome home, and it's a shame. These days, as a society, we have learned how to separate how we feel about a policy from how we treat the men and women sent overseas to serve. That wasn't true for Vietnam veterans. I'm sorry that not everyone got thanked properly. I'm sorry that this is coming late. But on behalf of the city of South Bend, I hope you'll forgive that this message is coming late, but maybe not too late. Thank you, and welcome home. Recognizing Vietnam Veterans Day has only begun in the last few years, but it quickly became another occasion for me to see how important a symbolic act can be. Some of the vets' eyes water. It's clear that to them, the honor, however late in their lives, is meaningful. One of them tells me he was 18 when he went, says he'll never forget the things he saw, but dwells on the ways in which he feels luckier than others who came back unable to move on. They called me a baby killer when I got back, he says, staring into the distance. I try to picture what coming back from war was like in the 1960s and 1970s. Without the benefit of email or Facebook or cell phones, your family perhaps not even sure what day to expect you until you could reach them from a payphone on your way back. One vet describes a friend whose reunion with family happened at this very bar. He returned one afternoon, found his family's home empty, and knew that they must be at this tavern across the street. By the time I was on my way home, 40 years later, Big Navy had learned some things about the art of preparing a service member to return. Somewhere in between Vietnam and now, the Pentagon had realized that the day after you leave a war zone is not the best time to reunite with your family. So we were given 3 days interlude at a little base in rural Germany that amounted to a kind of no-frills resort. There was ample time for working out and sleep, and they even organized little trips into town. It almost felt like tourism, but the intent was to watch and help you respond as elements of normal life were gradually restored around you. As we wandered in small groups around the market square of a small city nearby, someone from the command was always on hand to keep an eye on each little first of reintegration. They were normal things from home that we hadn't experienced in a while, things we might not be able to handle as easily as we expected. First walk through a crowd, first time in the presence of children, first drink. The rest of the hours were for sessions on things like dealing with stress. As a mild-mannered captain led a session on psychological triggers, I sank into my seat at the mention of one I hadn't thought of, politics and politicians. Remember as you go home that this is an election year, he said. There's a lot of political advertising about war and military issues that we found is a stressor, so you may want to steer clear of that. Gradually, we dismantled our active-duty mindsets and selves and prepared mentally to return. At a folding table, I sat giving my disassembled M4 and M9 one last exhaustive cleaning before yielding them immaculate back to Uncle Sam, along with the other gear, from Gore-Tex parkas to a gas mask. Most of the contents of the 3 sea bags of HUA I'd been issued in Norfolk went into various large bins and boxes to be reissued to the next person who comes along. Pants, shirts, boots, and the like were mine to keep. Then, after our 3-day sojourn, I was munching on ham and cheese sandwiches lovingly packed for us by the USO at Ramstein and boarding a 747 for Baltimore. Back at Norfolk, the focus shifted from our personal well-being to our physical and bureaucratic health. A flurry of paperwork saw to it that we were realigned with parent commands, registered for the VA, and clear of any number of physical ailments. Someone with a clipboard asked how many weeks of leave I was going to take. You were entitled to several and urged to use them. But I couldn't be back in South Bend and not be mayor for long. I asked for the longest I figured I could get away with, 1 week. At the airport in Detroit, waiting for the connection to South Bend, I realized that being in uniform among civilians is a bit like being an elected official among residents. Heads turn, a few people come to shake your hand, and others glance at you but then look away. I looked for a seat in a quiet corner of the gate, and then got to talking with a lady sitting next to me who was on her way to visit relatives. She didn't know me from Adam, and as we sat describing her relatives and my own time in the service, I felt for a moment like this might be the last normal conversation I would have for a while. Another passenger, seated across from us, looked up at me with a discreet, knowing smile as my new acquaintance asked, "So, is South Bend home for you?" South Bend's airport director had kindly arranged for my parents to come through security so that I could greet them before facing the crowd and the cameras. Mom held a rose, and she and Dad looked as relieved as you would expect. After a few hugs and a few words, it was time to go out into the main concourse and start being mayor again. It was about 9 in the evening, and I'd only been able to give a few hours' notice to my team, but a sizable crowd was waiting. One city council member, who had opposed nearly every major initiative I had put forward, barreled past everyone else to embrace me in a bear hug as if I were a long-lost brother, small American flags poking out of his suit pockets. A bit more reservedly, other colleagues, friends, and strangers greeted me one by one. Mark Neal, who had stood in for me, was there, as was Catherine Roos, who had run the office in my absence. There was Governor Kernan, Mrs. Chismar from St. Joe High School, Father Brian from St. James, and some young kids I'd never seen before who had made a welcome home poster. And there were the TV cameras, of course. I knew it was my job to give a little speech, and I had prepared in my head what to say. A thank you to everyone who had helped run the city, to the community that had supported me, and to everyone who came to help welcome me back. I got as far as mentioning that not everyone would get to come home like this, or at all, and began to choke up, barely getting out the rest of what I had to say. I have no memory of the rest of the evening, except that Mom and Dad saw to it that I got home, and that a burger was waiting for me on the dining room table. I ate it as gratefully as I have any meal, before or since. My staff held back for a few days while I unpacked my gear and reacquainted myself with my house, friends, and family. But the following Monday, it was time to get back to work. Each department had a list of updates and pending decisions. Resuming the routine of TV appearances, meetings, emails, and decisions wasn't that hard, but regaining a civilian mentality took longer than I expected. I found myself speaking frequently with Brian Pulowski, my deputy chief of staff and a Marine Iraq veteran, about how to make sure I was taking the residents' concerns as seriously as they did, even when everything seemed to have less urgency than what I was used to overseas. One day, soon after I returned, Catherine came into the office with a worried expression to let me know there had been a bomb threat at the courthouse nearby. I walked over to the window and peered down at the courthouse complex, then turned and thanked her for the heads up. "Good to know," I said, "but unless it's a huge bomb, we're probably outside the blast radius. It would have to be a 500-pounder, which doesn't seem likely, so I wouldn't worry too much." I nodded appreciatively and went back to my desk to resume working, while she gave a sidelong glance and retreated into the hall. A few minutes later, she knocked on the door again, probably after consulting Brian, to tactfully ask if I was thinking as a civilian when I was reacting. She wanted to see if evacuating the building might be appropriate, and I took the point. We agreed to check with the fire chief. The threat turned out to be a false alarm. Getting into a car, I would sometimes pull so hard the door would fly open and bounce on its hinge. forgetting this was not the heavy armored Land Cruiser door I was used to. And merging onto a highway one day with my mother in the passenger seat, I caught myself just in time before barking, "Clear right," to her, as I would to the gunny sergeant to make sure we could safely proceed. The community was not just accommodating but effusive, too much for my comfort. Someone organized a welcome home event at the Century Center, complete with a visit by the South Bend Cubs mascot. I felt uneasy, especially when Joe Kernan, an actual war hero, came on stage to thank me for my service. I was proud to have served, but I was one of hundreds of thousands, most of whom had nothing like this kind of welcome. The only way to reconcile the treatment I was getting was to tell myself and the audience that I accepted their well wishes on behalf of everyone else who had served, and those still out there. There were exceptions to the kindness. One far-right blog ran a piece titled, "South Bend Welcomes Spook Mayor Back Home. What Have You Done For Us Lately, Pete?" The article said the public of South Bend, quote, "still hasn't figured out that the man they elected as mayor has likely been working for the CIA all along," end quote. A still nuttier individual showed up at a speech I was giving and demanded to know if I was prepared to admit that the CIA had introduced heroin to Afghanistan. But there wasn't time for battling with conspiracy theorists any more than there was time to wallow in some kind of patriotic glow. The rhythms of South Bend waited for no one, and it was time to get back to work. The budget was due for passage in a matter of days. There was just 1 year to go on the 1,000 houses in 1,000 days effort. It was almost time to announce my plan to run for re-election. And, I had realized, it was time to get serious about sorting out my personal life. Chapter 16. Becoming One Person. If not for the deployment, I might never have found my way to Chaston. Before going overseas, I had felt comfortable being more than one person, as we all sometimes must, according to the roles we are called to play. I knew how to toggle between mayor mode, officer mode, friend mode, and so on. But something about exposure to danger impresses upon you that a life is not only fragile but single, with one beginning and one end. It heightens the desire for your life to make sense as a whole, not just from certain angles. And with this comes renewed pressure for internal contradictions to be resolved, one way or another. For me, that meant sudden urgency around a question that had lingered unanswered for all of adulthood: how to reconcile my professional life with the fact that I'm gay. In the years after I had figured this fact out for myself, but before I was ready to be open about it, dating seemed completely off the table. Even if I had sought to have a romantic life before coming out, I'm not sure I could have figured out how to pull it off. My friends and peers were all busy dating, coupling, marrying. But sitting out never felt like a huge sacrifice to me, because keeping up with my studies and work was consuming all the energy I had, especially once I was elected. The city was a jealous bride. But that effect started to wear off as I got older. I had always wanted to have a family, and crossing into my 30s made clear that the vague and distant future in which I expected that to happen couldn't remain vague and distant forever. If I really wanted a family, sooner or later, I would need to take some actual steps in that direction. The problem was that there is no way to raise a child, or in my case, go on a date in your own city, unless you were prepared to live openly. Steadily, with each close friend's wedding or emailed baby news, the force of this simple truth gained ground against my awareness of the professional peril holding me back. But that peril was real. My military career was theoretically safe, now that the "don't ask, don't tell" policy had been repealed. I no longer stood to lose my commission as an officer merely for living openly. But what about my civilian job? South Bend had an ordinance forbidding discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation. I myself had signed it into law in 2012 after it passed in our council. But it was not exactly applicable in my case. As an elected official, your boss is the people of the city. If the people fire you for being gay, it might be discrimination, but it's not like you can sue them. I was also not eager to become a poster child for LGBT issues. I had strongly supported these causes from the beginning, but did not want to be defined by them. So I might have kept dragging my feet through my 30s, too, if it hadn't been for the deployment. But preparing the letter on my last day before leaving home, sealing it in an envelope marked "just in case," and setting it gently in the desk drawer, had required as much of me as the hardest day of training. It forced me to think about the cohesion, or lack thereof, in my life. I had packed my bags reflecting on the possibility that I might get killed in action, 32 years old, single for basically all my adult life. From then on, it was obvious that if I did come home all right, I needed to come out so I could get on with some kind of personal life. After I safely returned, it was simply a matter of when. Before explaining it to the world, I had to explain it to some people in my life. For every important step you take, certainly in politics, but in life more generally, there is a do not surprise list. In my case, the top of the list was Mom and Dad. I felt they would be supportive, but for some reason, I had not found the courage to include them in the tiny number of friends I had told. And so, at my parents' dinner table one Sunday evening in January of 2015, I found myself, a grown man and the mayor of a sizable city, sweating through my palms and pushing remnants of ice cream around with a spoon while working up the will to change the subject of conversation from an upcoming council meeting to the fact that their son, their only child, was attracted to men. "I wanted to tell you something," I finally managed to begin. "Okay," Dad said, both of them subtly and quietly bracing. Announcements of any kind are not typical at this dinner table. Then, after a short preamble consisting of what I'm sure were a few convoluted sentences about moving ahead in life and being transparent with those around me, I made my way to the phrase that had to be said out loud. "I'm gay." They weren't terribly surprised. I hadn't brought a girlfriend home in more than a decade, and I think they understood what to make of my not mentioning any kind of romantic life in the years since. The close friends I had told included some who were surprised, some who were not, and some who had assumed as time went by that I was more or less asexual. But simply by virtue of being my parents, they probably understood all this long before I did. Both made it clear that it didn't change anything in our relationship as a family. If any disappointment surfaced at the table that night, it came after Mom looked at me with a little light in her eyes and asked, "Is there someone?" Only after answering no, and seeing the light fade a little, did I realize that the tone of her question had been one of hope. As moms go, she had been pretty sparing with any pressure to produce grandchildren, but I still knew that nothing would bring more joy to her life. Her hopeful question, and my disappointing answer, made for one more reason that I had to figure out a way to go public, so I could begin adding this dimension to my life. No, there wasn't someone at the moment, but I wished there were. And if I could figure out the process of coming out publicly, then one day there would be. Someday, politicians won't have to come out as gay any more than one comes out as straight. Someone like me would just show up at a social function with a date who is of the same sex, and everyone would figure it out and shrug. Maybe it's already getting to be like that in some coastal cities, but not in Indiana, especially not after the religious freedom debacle exploded that same spring of 2015. The very season when I was asking friends for advice on how to approach coming out publicly was the spring in which my state became nationally infamous for one of the most visible backward lurches on LGBT equality. Coming out was supposed to be a personal hurdle for me to clear, not a political statement, but doing so now meant that it would be even more freighted with the complications of being openly gay in Mike Pence's Indiana. It became obvious that, no matter how I did it, disclosing this very private aspect of my life would be viewed by strangers through a political lens. And the closer I came to feeling ready, having told most of my close friends and alerted my campaign staff, the more it became not just a political question, but a practical one. How exactly was I supposed to do this? The whole idea of having to come out irritated me. Why should it be anyone's business? But I knew that in the current atmosphere, just casually mentioning it somewhere, or being seen out with a male date, would set off weeks or months of confusion, speculation, and clarification. What I needed to do was to get this out there, simply, publicly, and clearly. The churn of life in office doesn't lend itself to reflection and preparation for important life decisions. But here again, the military played a helpful role in the form of a forced change of scene. Still in the reserve, I owed the Navy 2 weeks a year of active duty for training, and in June, I was to go to the Defense Intelligence Agency headquarters in Washington for a course on military intelligence. Strange as it sounds, this stint of military duty was almost like a vacation. I would be expected to work just 40 hours a week, a positively relaxing tempo compared to my schedule as a full-time mayor running for re-election. It was a kind of political Sabbath. There was time to work out, eat properly, catch up with old friends over dinner, and get a good night's sleep. My phone would not be going off constantly in my pocket. It wasn't even allowed inside the secure area. And no one, besides the occasional acquaintance I might run